Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Academic Life. This is the podcast for your academic journey and beyond. I'm the show's creator and the show host, Dr. Christina Gessler, and today we're joined by David Moss Masumoto, who is the author of Secret Harvest, A Hidden Story of Separation and the Resilience of a Family Farm. In his new memoir, Moss discovers his lost aunt. She had been taken away in 1942 when all Japanese Americans were considered the enemy and imprisoned. Due to a disability, she then became a ward of the state. His family believed she had died. Then came a surprising phone call. She was alive, living a few miles away from their family farm. As Moss discovers, every family has secrets, silences, and lives amongst their unanswered questions. As Moss learns about his aunt, he asks, how did she survive? Why was she kept hidden? The book interrogates how both shame and resilience empowered his family to forge forward in a land that did not want them. Moss shares how he is driven to explore his identity and the meaning of family, especially as farmers tied to the land. In doing so, he uncovers family secrets that bind his family to a sense of history, buried in the earth they work, and a sense of place that defines them. Secret Harvest is a story of a family separated by racism against Japanese Americans and the discrimination of people with developmental disabilities, reunited 70 years later, returning to their roots on a farm and bound by family secrets. Welcome to the show, Moss. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I am so glad that you're here and that you're going to share this book with listeners. I know the book is a memoir and it's very personal, but before we dive into that, will you please tell us about yourself?
Well, first of all, Christina, it's really an honor to be part of this conversation. I look forward to exploring different topics. Myself, I'm an organic peach, nectarine, and raisin farmer in a small town south of Fresno, California. I'm the author of a bunch of books, and I tend to, in my writing, use a kind of creative nonfiction approach to looking at the world around me, especially the world of food, family farming, and the stories that connect us. I grew up on this family farm, and like a lot of good farm kids, I ran off to college because I didn't want to farm, and I ended up going to Berkeley because I thought that would be the one campus my parents wouldn't come to bother me at, and they never did come visit me. But as part of my education, I spent about 2 years in Japan, and I was exploring our roots because my grandparents had immigrated from southern and rural parts of Japan. So I end up exploring a family farm that my grandmother had left, decades ago. And I was growing and working in the rice fields. And it occurred to me, I don't know anything about growing rice. I know peaches and grapes, but not rice. So it made me realize that I wanted to come back to the farm to just explore life back here. So I did come back and started farming with my parents. I did take a little time off to get a master's degree in community development at UC Davis. But interestingly, my thesis at UC Davis was an oral history of Japanese American family farmers. And it was a wonderful way to reintroduce myself to this farm community by interviewing my neighbors and finding out their life story. And it sort of catapulted lifted me into this world of stories that I continued to explore, write about, and farm about too.
Is that what launched you as a writer? Because you share a little bit in the book about when you were at Berkeley and you have a heartbreak and you describe yourself as someone writing bad poetry. And that doesn't really foreshadow that you're going to write so many books.
Well, in a funny way, I thought, oh, I could write poetry and explore emotions. And the poetry ended up sounding like bad country western songs where, you know, you took my heart and stomped on it type stuff. And I was like, this is pathetic. And I realized what I was interested in was almost from a journalist viewpoint, looking at the real stories that are embodied lives out there. And that's why I never I thought, oh, maybe I couldn't write novels. But whenever I started writing fiction, I ended up writing nonfiction, sticking to the things I knew, exploring the topic by asking more questions. And that continued, especially with this book, Secret Harvest, which explores family secrets. And I wanted to explore that topic as someone who writes nonfiction, not fiction.
And we get glimpses of that in the book. You say things like, if this scene was a movie, it would be like X, Y, and Z, but it's not. If I was a journalist, I could handle this family history like this, but I can't. If I had the distance of a historian where I was looking at data and documents and artifacts, I could approach it like this, but I can't. If it was a novel, it would be like this, but it isn't. It's so much harder to do creative nonfiction than to just make stuff up.
Absolutely right. I think, and again, novelists are fantastic, and perhaps part of me wishes I could be a novelist, because in exploring family secrets, you're going to find out there are things you don't know, these missing pieces of information, things that some people won't share with you. And you have to almost use your imagination to ask the next question. But for me, it was always that silence was part of the story. So when I'm looking into this lost aunt that's at the heart of Secret Harvest, the book, there were gaps. And I realized those gaps are part of the history of my family, part of the legacy that I inherit. So I wanted to write about those gaps and leave them as bits of information I don't know. I think it was very authentic that way. And also it allowed me to explore this topic in a very realistic way, because all of our families, we have gaps in the history. And you have to ask, why do you have those gaps? Was it purposeful to have gaps because silence actually is part of most of our family histories, or is it something else that was driving those kind of gaps that we have in our memories?
Some listeners won't have seen a copy of the book yet. Could you give us your synopsis of it?
The story began when got a phone call actually from a funeral home. This wonderful woman at the funeral home had gotten this contract to take care of someone who turned out to be my lost aunt. And so she phoned me, and I didn't believe her, because I said, no, I know all my family. This isn't the lost aunt. But I explored it. I went to visit her. I went to go and looked at some of the data. I went to go visit this woman who was in hospice at the time. That's why she was had the contract with the funeral home. And it turned out it was this lost aunt that I vaguely remember the name. I remember seeing her name on some family trees. And she was separated from the family in 1942, and all of our family thought she had passed away. And it turns out 70 years later, she's alive a few miles from our farm in an assisted care center. And that began this journey into exploring this legacy of a family secret. Why did no one talk about her? What happened to her? And what was the story? And part of the story was, when she was a child in 1925, she contracted meningitis, which affected her intellectual mental development. So she was, as the term we used to use, mentally retarded. And the family had to cope with that as best they can. And it was an era where people with a kind of intellectual disability were often hidden and kept invisible. And then in 1942, when all Japanese Americans on the West Coast were forced to be relocated, imprisoned because they looked like the enemy, my family didn't know what to do with this aunt. Her name was Shizuko. And so they said, because they didn't know where these relocation camps would be like, if they would be abilities to care for a daughter, a sister that had an intellectual disability. So she became a ward of the state, and she went into the California institutional system, and we all thought she had perished. And then suddenly, 70 years later, I get this phone call. She's alive in Fresno. And I try to piece together this history. And for the next 2 years after that phone call, amazingly, this lost aunt woke up, and we had to cope with, deal with this living secret. And that was part of what I explored in Secret Harvests.
And Secret Harvest takes us back and forward in time. As you find out more, you have to go backwards and try to find out what else you don't know. And a lot of it keeps going back to 1942 and what was happening with your family. There was the father had stomach cancer, if I have this correctly, and there was great uncertainty about how he could make the journey to the relocation camp and how they could take care of him and your aunt at the same time. And in making the plan for your aunt, in going back and looking through those stories, you realize this was the most responsible choice they could make out of a series of only bad choices available to them.
One of the challenges when you look at family history is we tend to judge history by today's standards. And for this book, because it was a nonfiction book, I wanted to go back to, 1925. What was it like to have this major disease that swept across the nation? Meningitis in the 1920s killed millions of American infants. And we sort of forget that happened. And I remember asking my mom, well, when Shizuko had meningitis, why didn't you get some help? And my mom looked at me and said, we were poor, we were rural, and at the same time, we were Buddhist. And you have to realize many medical facilities back in that era were Christian-based. So the family knew they couldn't get any help. So they just had to live with this disease. And by putting it back in that moment, you begin to say, I need to reimagine what was it like in 1925, in the 1930s, in the Great Depression, trying to raise a child with an intellectual disability. But also in 1942, this is after Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor, and suddenly Japanese Americans, including my mom, for example, who was 13 at the time, was perceived to be the enemy. And they were rounded up and forced to relocate. And they had about a week after this notice was posted to pack all their things. And you go back to that moment in time. And again, instead of judging it by, well, today's standards, we should have gone to this. We should have filed the lawsuit. You go back to that moment in time. My family, again, were poor. They were farm workers. They were rural. What choice did they have? And they had no idea what was going to happen. They had no idea where they were even going. They ended up going to the deserts of Arizona, and where friends and that we lived in Fresno, which is 10 miles from where my family had lived, they ended up going to Jerome, Arkansas, a completely different state and a completely different thing. It made me realize people had no idea what the future is going to be. That's when I realized, they had to make this very, very difficult choice, and they made that choice.
And they made the one that they felt was best for her. They were able to say goodbye to her. They were able to know where she was going. There must have been a very real fear if they took her with them that then she might be forcibly taken from them and put somewhere else that they had no say over.
One of the elements I explored in Secret Harvest was this whole notion of how the world dealt with intellectual disability. Again, this wasn't a physical disability. It was an intellectual. And, you know, I remember exploring the terms that I grew up with, where we used the term mentally retarded. And we realized back in that era, there was this whole culture of shame if someone had an intellectual disability. And you realize that culture of shame, which was wrong, but it was the dominant belief people had. And therefore, when someone had a child with an intellectual disability, what do you do with it? There was this other idea of the unknown that went with it at the same time. So my family was faced with a decision, and they thought they'd made the best choice they could. And ironically, my aunt Shizuko survived for 70 years in institutional care. And when we got that phone call, she was 90 years old. It was stunning. In a way, it was the exact right choice, because my aunt survived 70 years and was still alive after all that. So in hindsight, yeah, they made the exact right choice. But certainly at that time, it was had to be what they thought the best of many poor situations and decisions that they had at that moment.
And you share in the book that in addition to only being given a week, they were told they were only going to be allowed to take one suitcase, and few people had someone they could trust to leave any personal belongings with. Few people had any hope that any property, personal or otherwise, that they had amassed would be kept for them in any safe way.
One of the things you have to realize, again, trying to go back in a moment of history and understanding the confusion, the chaos, the terror, the fear that was sweeping things. And yet you have to pack everything in one suitcase. And I remember growing up, how come we don't have photographs of, you know, my grandparents when they first arrived in America? Well, one, photographs weren't that prevalent back then. We didn't have iPhones to take all these pictures. And secondly, you know, when you were photographers and pictures were expensive. There were very, very few photographs taken of it. And the third thing was, what do you pack? When you have to put everything you have in a suitcase, you know, you pack some clothes, maybe. Maybe you pack a few mementos, but that's about it. And you realize, too, you didn't know if you were coming back either. Because my family spent 4 to 5 years in the Arizona desert before they ended up coming back. They did not know what the future was going to be like. So as a result, then, there was this huge sense of confusion swaying around this, in addition to my grandfather at that time was dying of stomach cancer. So I write in the book to try to reimagine and re-picture that moment. He ended up getting on the train, because they got on trains going down to Arizona. They went through LA, and in LA, they tried to remove my grandfather because he was sick. He was dying, and he refused to get off the train. And the family didn't want to separate him, but they also knew he was sick, but they didn't know what would become of him. So he continued on to Gila River Relocation Center, south of Phoenix in the Arizona desert. And my grandfather was one of the first to die and pass away in this relocation center. And I remember an uncle told me the story that they didn't know what to do with the body. And my uncle, in a kind of bittersweet way, said they were glad they didn't have these crematories or anything set up in these relocation camps, as opposed to what these images and stories you heard of, certainly the concentration camps during World War II in Germany for Jews. The Japanese Americans, my uncle told me the story that they didn't know what to do with the body, and they ended up taking him to a mortuary in a nearby town outside of the desert area they were at. But it was just one of those moments of history where you piece together a few details to give you a sense of what was life like at that moment.
And part of what you piece together is your grandmother suddenly becomes a single mom, and your mother does all of high school while she's interned.
My mom almost felt guilty because, again, she was a teenager. At this moment where they're living behind barbed wire. And she felt guilty because suddenly she's surrounded by, you know, thousands of classmates her age. And she actually said she had some good moments in there where they set up high school and they set up in these relocation centers, high schools, and they had some sports programs and they had dances. And my mom would tell me story of going to these dances. Again, she's 13, 14, 15 years old, and she ends up graduating in this relocation center school. So she had a very different experience than my father, who had just finished high school in a nearby town here, and he was looking forward to his next phase of his life, and then instead he was thrown into prison for these 4 years. And again, one of those details that sort of capture the insanity of the moment. During World War II in 1945, it was uncertain which direction the war was going to go. So my dad got drafted into the U.S. Army out of this relocation camp, and he went to serve, to fight for this country that was imprisoning his family. All of those details to me are mind-blowing, but yet they were part of that moment of history that they lived through, and it was all the backdrop, again, to my aunt, my lost aunt Shizuko, with this intellectual disability, surviving all these years. So in an amazing way, writing this book gave me a license to probe into these moments of our family history, but a moment of the history of America, to understand these were the dynamics that were unfolding at this moment when we were fighting this war. And it was about patriotism and defining who was American and who was free. And then my family was living in this contrast, this dichotomy of what was going on in the world. And it all became part of this legacy that I and my family inherited.
And you share in the book that these were silences, these were secrets. One might think that families want to tell these stories, but they don't. They want to survive it and go forward. You had to ask in a number of ways over a period of time through, it sounds like, very gentle conversations. You couldn't push to ask these questions.
My family grew up, first of all, they were farm workers and then farmers, very rural Japanese Americans. There was this kind of culture of being quiet, of being silent. And I remember talking to my aunts and uncles about, why were you so quiet? And I remember one uncle said it was because that's how we would be accepted. Because again, because of the way they looked, they were deemed the enemy. And I had to stop and think, would I have been quiet at that time because it was the way to be accepted? So we had end up this culture of silence, you might want to call it that. And understanding that was the framework that they used to survive. And they did. They survived all that. But it also made it very, very difficult in terms of getting these stories, because my family were not a family of storytellers. We had a lot of silence around dinner tables, but it was part of the world I grew up with. And part of writing Secret Harvest was to examine the meaning of silence. And in a way, it was some of the most powerful moments of this book, was capturing why they were silent. They were silent because they were trying to cope trying to figure out a way that they would be accepted. And at the same time, understanding that silence permeated a lot of different dynamics of being an immigrant, being a non-Christian, and again, being someone who is deemed and looked different than, quote, real Americans. That silence, though, was all part of how I approached doing the research for this book, because my family wouldn't sit down and start rattling off stories like we are now. They were very, very different. So it was like over the course of literally months and years, trying to get a little tidbit of one story, you know, and I was very good at making notes, and then going back the next time I saw an aunt, or next time I visited my mom and said, "Mom," you know, and again, my mom lives about you know, a quarter mile away from on a different part of the farm. So I'd see her daily and figuring out when was the right time to bring up this subject, because you're dealing with family and family secrets. And as you brought up, often families don't want to tell these stories. That's part of the story. Why are these kept secret? And in an amazing way, you'll find that it wasn't just necessarily that there was something evil about it. It was part of the history. The silence and the secrecy was part of our family histories. And I would claim it's part of all family histories. I remember doing some research into this book and talking with some friends. And this one woman said, you know, I want to tell you a secret. She said, when I was growing up with my sister, my mom said that our grandfather, the mom's father, had died. And I went, wow. And then this friend said, but you know, when we went to Mexico to visit an aunt, imagine our surprise when the aunt said, would you like to meet your grandfather? That was an amazing story that was embedded in it. And understanding why there was the secrecy is the important part of that story.
It also explains why when you got the phone call, you didn't immediately go get your mother. You didn't immediately go call other people in the family. You just started looking into this yourself. You first wanted to make sure this was a legitimate story, but you also wanted to figure out how to tell the family.
Oh, exactly. I mean, again, you get a phone call from a funeral home, that doesn't make sense. All right. It was back when we had answering machines. And I remember I listened to it and I go, oh, this is just, a funeral home trying to sell an early arrangement for my own funeral. I said, I'm not going to phone them back. And they phoned back again like two or three times. And my wife said, you know, you should phone them back. So I phoned them back and got the initial part of the story. And again, I didn't believe it. And I then went to go visit wonderful woman named Renee Johnson at this funeral home in Fresno, who had such a good heart because she didn't want Shizuko, my aunt, Shizuko, to die alone. So she was trying to find her family. And they got our phone number. I mean, even that was an ironic story. My father had passed away a few years earlier, and I wrote the obituary for my father. And in the obituary, there's this tradition that you write, Joe Takashi Masumoto married Carol (parentheses) Sugimoto Masumoto, and my aunt's name was Shizuko Sugimoto, of course, my mom's side of the family. But because I put in parentheses my mom's maiden name, they were able to look up Carol Sugimoto on the U.S. Census in 1930s that got the connection with this funeral home. So she phoned me and I went to go talk with her. I still didn't believe it. I went to go talk with the regional center who was handling the caseload of my aunt because, again, she was a ward of the state. All the information and data looked correct. I went to go visit Shizuko in the assisted care center. Again, she was in a coma in hospice at that time. All the pieces fit together. So then I decided, and this is after like maybe a week or two, I said, all right, let me go talk with my mom, because it was going to be a very, very difficult conversation. I knew it would be, because we all thought she had passed away. And it wasn't about the idea of shock value. It was actually the idea of how do you probe family stories, and especially the secrets that embody all of our families.
And you say that on page 84, you say, how do you tell your family that after 70 years, you found their sister and aunt? And a few pages later, you say, family mysteries haunt us all. No one has a perfect past.
Oh, exactly. Because I have found, and this is could be an exercise that, you and your listeners could do. Ask other people that, do you know family secrets? And it'd be amazing how people start rattling off things. A neighbor who of ours, he asked, what book are you writing about? And then I said, oh, I'm writing this book about family secrets. And he said, oh, you know, we just went to a family reunion. And I just found out that, you know, my father, who was fought in World War II and ended up being in Germany as part of the post-war, you know, contingent of American soldiers there, fell in love with a German woman and they had a child. And this father wanted to bring back this wife to America. And she said, no, I want to stay in Germany. It's okay. You could leave. So he came back to America, started a family here, and they had a family reunion a couple of years ago, had looked up through some genetics information, this separate part of the family, and ended up having this family reunion with this German side of the family. Again, it was kept secret for decades because it was deemed as being awkward, but here later, families have secrets to share. Another quick story. Again, I was talking to my mechanic, right? This chain smoking guy who said, hey, you know, are you writing a book? And I said, yeah, I'm writing a book about family secrets. And he said, huh, well, let me tell you a secret in my family. When I was growing up, my sister had two birthdays. And I said, what do you mean she had two birthdays? And he goes, let me tell you, my sister had a birthday in November that the grandparents celebrated, but her real birthday was in July because the parents had gotten married in March. And I suddenly started counting on my fingertips and realized, huh, when the parents had gotten married, she was already pregnant. She had this sister, this daughter in July, but the grandparents wouldn't approve of that. So they made up the story that the sister had her real a second birthday in November. And it all told the story of that moment in history, those times that we lived in, and the dynamics that how families coped with these different family secrets. And now, wonderfully, you could talk about more of those type of things, but it does capture that moment of how all families have these secrets. And they really tell a lot about what our families were, the values they had, and the dynamics of that moment in history. And it becomes a wonderful history lesson in many ways.
It sounds in the book like when you set out to get to know your aunt Shizuko, you had hoped there would be more information available about her, that you could open more of these silences, that you could bring more to light. But because she was a ward of the state and not of your family, sometimes they literally said to you, we can't tell you that.
I mean, again, when you go through those legal parameters and you give up, you might say, you know, rights to a family member, you become anonymous. And so in many ways, you know, legally, were we her family? I remember talking with an attorney and they said, oh, you should, you know, file a claim and you should be able to get some information. And I bet I could. On the other hand, not having that information was also part of this family story, this legacy that's in Secret Harvest. When I write about these dynamics, one of the challenges of writing this book, to give, you know, your listeners a little insight, was how do you deal with what you don't know? How do you know what you don't know? That statement became part of this book because I don't know a lot of these details, and it's as if I'm not supposed to know. Because again, thinking back at this, my Aunt Shizuko's amazing life, how does she survive those decades of institutional care? Because we all have these images of institutional care, of being very hard, very, very primitive, abusive in many ways. And, you know, what was her way of surviving? Again, my aunt had the intellectual capacity of probably a five-year-old. I'm not so sure how she's viewed the world, because it may have been on just a day-to-day basis. And it dawned on me, perhaps that's how she survived all those years. She lived from day to day. And in talking to all of the caregivers that had taken care of her, like at this assisted care center in Fresno, they had taken care of her for the last 15 years. They told me stories about how this wonderful, quiet aunt, and again, she's about 4'6", weighed about 80 pounds, very, very tiny year old, 80-year-old running around this assisted care center. And they said she was full of life. She had this energy. And again, I start imposing my images of, wait a minute, she has this, you know, intellectual disability. She's in an assisted care center. What do you mean she's full of life? This doesn't make sense. But it made me realize, no, this was this other reality, this other kind of life that I had to understand my aunt went through, and that's how she survived. So I got these wonderful stories from the caregivers who themselves were wonderful and amazing because their story becomes part of this secret harvest. Their story of people who are often people of color, people who are, you know, low income, poor, they're the ones that are taking these jobs that are low paying, and they're caring for all these people who are often forgotten and invisible. And they become part of this legacy of my family. And because of that, you know, it just moved me so much to think about that kind of dynamic and the power of their stories.
You weave throughout the book details of your life on the organic farm and the work you do to tend it. And when you get to the section where you're meeting caregivers and you're seeing the work that they do and the way that they work together in this care facility to support the people who live there, you make some parallels between their caregiving and your work tending and caring for the farm.
One of the main characters of this story is our farming and farming. Again, my grandparents were immigrants and they could not own land because there were many laws in California and in the Western states barring Orientals from land ownership. And it was called alien land laws. And they were specifically targeting Asians. And it's part of this racist law of who was allowed to farm in California and many Western states. Interestingly, I did look up this case of right at that time in the early 1900s, Armenians were coming into this area of California in the San Joaquin Valley. And there was a lawsuit. Are Armenians Asian or are they European? And literally the lawsuit said, no, Armenians are considered white Asians, so they are allowed to buy land. Where Japanese Americans, Chinese, they were not allowed to buy property. And it changed the course of my grandparents' life because they were always farm workers. Here's the dynamic, though. My dad was, in an amazing way, along with many other Japanese Americans, understood that the way to plant roots in America was to buy a farm. So my dad took a big gamble after World War II in 1948. He bought our 40 acres that we still farm today. That's the character, the backdrop of all the story, because this was the land that we farmed. These were also the fields that Japanese Americans had worked on. There's speculation that part of our farm, Japanese Americans worked on, and perhaps even my grandparents and Chizuko spent time on this farm, because many Japanese Americans were in these farm labor crews that pruned the vines, and we have 100-year-old grapevines in front of our house. That's part of this legacy. I want to understand and listeners to understand that legacy is all part of the work that I do, both farming and also writing. It's part of that grounding. That's part of the life that I live. No different than thinking of the farms that I have and work on. I wasn't the first ones here. Native American populations were walking this earth. Did they farm this? Probably not. Did they walk this? Yes. But it's also the other life in our land, everything from the biological life, the wildlife, but even the soil life. And it's all part of how I work on raising these organic peaches and nectarines and grapes and raisins. And also it's part of that organic life that's part of our family history that's woven into this ground. And that's why always the family farm was the backdrop of all the story about this lost Aunt Shizuko. Because my mom would tell me stories that because Shizuko had an intellectual disability, she never went to school. They didn't have special ed classes back then. So what did she do? She would often go out into the fields and the image that I had was in the fields, laying under a grapevine or a peach tree. Shizuko felt it was home because the grapevines and the peach trees weren't judging her that she had a disability. So there's this image that I tried to capture of maybe it was in the fields that Shizuko felt, quote, normal. She felt placed. And that perhaps gave her the strength to survive 70 years of institutional care because she had developed an identity of who she really was, and she continued that through those 70 years.
When you found where she was, you started sending letters to the extended family, and you include a number of those in the book. And when you were writing the letters, you felt time was quite limited, but that's not what happened.
Again, the story kept unfolding in the ways I could have never imagined. Again, when I first met Shizuko and introduced her to our family, she was in a coma. She was in hospice. She had suffered a stroke, and everyone thought she was going to pass away. So we were making funeral plans, memorial plans for her at that time. And in an interesting way, it provided a very nice closure for our family, that this was this lost sister that they had assumed she had passed away, so now they could bury her. There was going to be closure. Amazingly, the caregivers had figured out a way. She wasn't in this assisted care center. She wasn't in a ICU unit or some special med place. She was in an assisted care center, but these caregivers had figured out a way to sort of stir her and feed her liquid diet for 3 months. And I kept waiting, and my family said, well, let me know when she passes away. Keep us posted, keep us updated. And I'd go visit her laying in this bed and wonder, when is she going to pass away? 3 months later, she woke up. So I get this phone call from the assisted care center that, your aunt Shizuko. And I said, yes. And I thought they were going to say she had passed away. They said, she woke up. And I went, you're kidding. So I rushed over to go see her. Interestingly, she had woken up. And at that point, she had been in a wheelchair for the last couple of years, but she would always scurry around the hallways of this assisted care center. So I immediately went to go see her because I wanted to see what was this aunt like. And I went up to her and I introduced myself. And of course, she had no idea who I was. She looked at me and she kicked me. She kicked me in the shin, and I went, what's going on? And I looked down. She wanted her shoe tied. And it was a moment of realization that this is how she survived those decades of institutional care. She was a little outgoing. She had personality. And if she wanted something taken care of, like a shoe tied, she asked someone to help tie her shoe. That's how she survived. And it was in this one moment where I went, oh my gosh, this is a different aunt. She doesn't seem to be part of this quiet Japanese Americans. She had personality. So it was part of piecing together this other story that filled out the family legacy in many ways that was really rewarding to do that. So she woke up and she lived for about 2 more years. And then began this new journey of telling my mom, telling my aunts and uncles and my cousins, Shizuko, guess what? She woke up, and people had to have this second awkward family reunion with now the living sister aunt that we all thought had passed away.
You share in the book about really trying to fill the silences and see what you can find out. And you go to DeWitt, which had been a military hospital during the war, and then they converted it into a care facility, and she was there. At the point that you get there around 2015, it's a historical society. And in that process, you're able to meet her music teacher.
It was an amazing moment because I was trying to piece together this past. And I had found from her records that she was at this DeWitt Center, which is in Auburn, north of Sacramento in the foothills area. And I did some research. And DeWitt was originally built as a medical facility back in 1944, 45. And here's a twist of fate. It was built as a medical center because the government had perceived that it would be hard to win the war in the Pacific because Japan would not surrender. So as a result, there'd be a huge amount of casualties, and DeWitt was built for these soldiers that would come back and have to be taken care of medically at this center in the foothills of Sacramento area. And that's what it was originally built for. Here's a twist, though. Of course, the war ended because the U.S. government and military dropped the atomic bomb on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. The war did end up quickly, and DeWitt was never used as this medical facility. Another twist to all this as I'm piecing this together. My mom's side of the family, the Sugimotos, had immigrated from Hiroshima. We had family in Hiroshima that we lost a lot of contact with, and my mom always felt bad about that, but then she always just would shake her head and said, the atomic bomb changed history. And she was looking at it from a family perspective, because we forget that it wasn't just a war, but civilians died when this atomic bomb was dropped. It changed family legacies in that sense. So suddenly that detail comes woven into DeWitt Center. DeWitt Center was then converted over in the 1950s to be one of those large mental institutions for wards of the states, for patients to live with, and it housed thousands of the residents, and my Aunt Shizuko was one of them. So while I was visiting this, trying to piece this all together, this facility, which was large, I mean, it occupied, you know, I don't know, 20, 30 acres, they had all these barracks that were built, again, designed for military facilities and then transferred into barracks for these mental patients. My aunt was there until about the 1970s, when California decommissioned a lot of these large mental institutions. And there's a twist that at that time, Shizuko came back to the Fresno area. So when I'm at DeWitt, I run into the Historical Society and I meet a music teacher who taught at DeWitt. And of course, I asked, did you happen to know my aunt? And she said, no, I couldn't remember that many people because I was, you know, the music teacher for the whole institution. And I said, well, you know, what was it like? And then I said, so did you form little like musical bands? And she says, oh yeah, you know, the patients. And again, these are all patients with some kind of intellectual disability. They'd form these sort of orchestras with percussion instruments and bells and whistles, and they would bang and out of rhythm. And I could picture Shizuko doing that because as I got to know her after she had woke up in the Fresno area, she was rambunctious. She was keeping her own rhythm. She would like pounding on things all the time. So I imagined her at DeWitt with this music teacher, pounding away on a bell or a percussion instrument along with 10, 20, 30 other patients. And I asked the music teacher, how did you cope with those erratic sounds? And the music teacher turned to me and said, you know, to me, it was music to my ears. And I realized that was part of that caregiving culture of people who took care of people. And it was music to her ears. And again, piecing together, this is how Shizuko survived. She was able to surround and was fortunate to be surrounded by people who cared for her. So then when we entered Shizuko's life, now we become part of this extended family that Shizuko had made. And again, this book wasn't just about Japanese Americans, but it was also about family farming and caring for the earth, caring for the legacy of family, and about caregivers and the parallel between caregivers who take care of life around them. And I like to think of my farming organically. It's sort of like looking at nature and how things grow and the chaos of nature, but it's also music to my ears, because this is organic life and organic farming and part of that legacy of our organic families.
And you open the book with the legacy. In the preface, it's called I Farm with Ghosts. Would you like to read to us from that?
Oh, I'd love to. And thank you for pointing that out, because I wanted to make sure the reader and the listener understood that when I farm, I don't farm alone. I farm with family and I farm with ancestors around me. So let me read the first section of this, the preface. I farm with ghosts. They live in our fields. Each peach tree has pruning scars from generations who worked these orchards. Every vine has been shaped by the hands of workers who returned each year to add their touch to the sculpture. People and their families have etched their marks on my farm, and I too hope to leave behind a simple signature on the seemingly ordinary landscape. Ghosts inhabit our family farm history. And that begins this whole journey into exploring family secrets and this lost aunt that opens the door to all these different dynamics and meaning of family.
You tell us in the book that when your grandfather realizes that they're going to be evicted from the farmhouse that they lived in because the woman who owns the property has already found someone to work, since they're going to be taken away for internment and they have no one to look after their things, he brings them all outside, he piles them up, and he sets them on fire.
Again, you try to understand things in historical context, and it's really hard sometimes because you want to quickly make a generalization. You know, my dad was a very, very quiet, stoic man. He loved silence. He worked in silence, and it was hard for me to get stories out of him because I remember when I first came back from Berkeley and started farming, you know, for the first 3 months, I ate every lunch with him, and I remember asking him a question about, the farm. And he would tell me just a snippet of story. For example, I said, "Hey, Dad, you know, I look on one of the top shelves in our barn, and there's a box that says dynamite. Why do we have dynamite?" And he says, "Oh, I use that to clear the fields." And then there was silence. And he wouldn't tell me any more until the next day. And the next lunch, I said, "Dad, tell me more about that dynamite that you use to clear the fields." And he said, "Well, I bought this farm because it was full of hardpan rock. And hardpan is really mineralized clay that creates these sheets and makes farming hard. And it was part of the legacy of our farm because my dad was able to afford this property because it was full of this hardpan rock and deemed fairly worthless. And that's why a poor farmer could buy a poor part of the earth to farm on, and he used dynamite to clear these fields out. Dynamite, rock by rock, clearing it out so it becomes the farm that I now work on." So that was part of these stories that took such a long time, and understanding that kind of historical context, that it was all part of it. So my dad then, you know, and again, it took a long time to get this story. They got the word that they had to leave the farm because they were going to be interned. It was in early August of 1942. Grapes for raisins would be picked at the end of August and September. And it was a very laborious type of farm work, where you had to pick each grape bunch and lay them on wooden trays that they did back then, and they dry in the sun into raisins. So my dad told the landlord at that time, because they were renting this land, of course they couldn't own it, that the government said we'd have to leave. So what do we do? And the landlord said, "Well, I'm going to give you a few dollars for the work that you did, but who's going to harvest this?" And it was a whole question and problem that was facing the farm raising industry in 1942, because this whole labor force would be uprooted and imprisoned. So the owner at that time said, I got to find something. So they found someone to take over the farm. And my dad said it was a, quote, oaky at that time. And again, if you think of Grapes of Wrath, a lot of migrant workers came from Oklahoma into the Valley, Central Valley, San Joaquin Valley of California. So they said that they would take harvest it, but they needed a place to live. So my dad got the word from the landlord that we want you out in 2 days. And my dad said, we're going to leave in a week. Can't we stay until then? And the landlord said, no, you have to leave now. So my dad said, and he got a neighboring farm, who was a good farmer, said, the family needs to stay someplace for a few more days. And the farmer said, well, you could sleep in our barn. So he moved the family, my grandparents and his brothers and sisters, to this barn, and they stayed there for a couple nights. Meanwhile, my dad went back to this house that they were renting, and he took out everything out of the house, the dishes, the cups that they had. He shattered them outside. He pulled out every other belonging because they couldn't take them with it, and he burned them. And this was this quiet, stoic farmer showing this moment of civil disobedience, this anger where he was trapped in the system, and what was he going to do? This was his own quiet protest. And to me, it told a tremendous amount of my dad's character and understanding that moment in our family history. And again, part of that legacy of farming that's part of embedded meaning for our family.
And it's part of where silences live. There's artifacts that are lost, photographs that are gone, documents that don't exist anymore, because of those moments when everything was gone. And yet you grew up in a farmhouse where the drawers were full of things, and you say in the book it's because you don't plan to leave a farm, so you keep everything. And so you grew up in a home where there were so many things. And one of the things that you found in one of the drawers was the documentation that your grandmother was a Gold Star mother.
Oh, again, a few things my family kept. And I'm the opposite, because I grew up on this farm, and I farmed it for decades, and I am continuing to farm, and I plan to die on this farm. I feel sorry for my son and daughter who's going to inherit this barn full of stuff, but I love it because it's all part of the legacy of our farm. And believe it or not, I actually use a lot of those old things too. But I remember going through my grandmother's dresser drawer, and she kept a few documents in there. You know, one was her alien registration card that she had kept because she was an alien, an immigrant, but she had this identification. But there was also this documentation showing that she was a Gold Star mother. And a Gold Star mother was signified that you had a son. Back then, it was all males, but you had a child who had died fighting in the war. And it began to piece together that there's another legacy involved with this story about family. And it was that I had an older uncle who was the eldest, the number one son in the family, who had been drafted into the U.S. Army before Pearl Harbor. So he was caught in this very, very difficult situation of being deemed the enemy, but yet being in the army at the same time. And I remember hearing the story that that they didn't know how to train in boot camp, so they started training them with fake guns. And I go, this makes no sense. It was the amazing contradictions of that moment. Well, this uncle joined the 442nd, which was this amazing battalion of all Japanese Americans that were joined together, and they fought these heroic, sometimes suicidal battles in Europe while their families were locked in prisons in America. So my uncle died in a battle in France, and my grandmother then became a Gold Star mother. And it was something she was proud of, but at the same time, she kept silent. And it was just like part of the legacy of Shizuko. These are stories, amazing stories, that were kept silent, and that's all part of this secret harvest that we have. It's all part of our legacies that I write about in the book, I struggle about in the book, and I continue to struggle with too, because I would be much more outgoing and much more verbal about things, but at the same time, trying to understand this. One of the breakthroughs in writing this book was the idea of understanding my parents and grandparents, just like Shizuko, really struggled and fought hard for acceptance. My generation, and you might say that we're much more American, we're much more outgoing, we are looking not for acceptance, but for belonging. And there's a huge difference between the two. And I think that's the struggles that cope with today's world, that we're all looking for. How do we belong in today's world? And how do things ranging from politics to economics to just everyday family, how does that all fit into this difference between being accepted versus belonging?
We're starting to run out of time. What do you hope listeners will take away?
Again, thank you so much. This has been an amazing conversation, and I hope you're enjoying it too. I hope listeners take away this idea that our family legacies are embedded in the history that all of our families have gone through. We don't live in isolation. We're all connected in these different and bizarre sometimes, but very, very special ways. And even these moments of silence and these moments of secrecy mean a lot in themselves. And it's part of that understanding of how our families belong in this context of history that leads to who we are today and our identities. And also, this is part of, you might call, generational trauma, generational legacy that we will pass on to our to others, either our children or our nieces and nephews. We will pass this on to others in our family and in our community too, to create meaning. And that's what I hope is for. And that's why I think I always wanted to write. I always wanted to write to explore meaning and tell those stories that surround us, because everyone has stories, just like all families have secrets.
Thank you so much for being here today, David Moss Masumoto, and sharing your book, Secret Harvests, A Hidden Story of Separation and the Resilience of a Family Farm. You've been listening to The Academic Life. Please join us again.